This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Mike Pesca in Washington. And congratulations, you've just won the lottery. Or is it condolences, you've won the lottery? Every year, roughly half of all Americans play. The word for most of them is losers. No judgment here. They just wind up losing more money than they win, if they win at all. But even the winners find that Easy Street is paved with a lot of potholes, like greedy family members, unrealistic expectation, and load of self-doubt. Enter the lump sum salesman. He'll buy your lottery winnings from you for current cents on future dollars. Lotteries are big business. You can even buy a $50 scratch-off card in a few states. Illinois is selling its state lottery. It could fetch $10 billion. Later on in the program, we'll be looking at strife in Kenya with a man who runs an orphanage just north of Nairobi from his home in Potomac, Maryland. But first, inside the life of the lottery, have you ever won the lottery? Do you play? Why? Give us a call. Our number here, or our Powerball numbers are 800-989-8255. With a supplementary number of 4. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining me in Studio 3A is Edward Ugel. He worked with lottery winners and the lump sum industry for years. He's just written a book about it titled Money for Nothing, One Man's Journey Through the Dark Side of Lottery Millions. Thanks for coming in today, Ed.
Pleasure, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Ed, start us off in the home of a winner. I'll ask you to start with a woman you call Sally. You walk into her home in Dallas. You can't help but noticing there are a couple of horses in the front yard, and the horses look pretty emaciated. What's going on there?
Winning the lottery does not make you a rodeo rider, that's for sure. You know, lottery winners come in all different shapes and sizes, but one thing that's sure is that you know, they tend to have some, at least once they win, some pretty extravagant ideas on fashion and design and home decorating. You know, this house, and it not too dissimilar to many houses that you end up in, as a traveling lump sum salesman, a title my parents were very proud of. You know, their gold is a predominant theme. You see a lot of gold. It looks like Donald Trump's funeral home. And, you know, everything's new. Obviously, you know, one of the things I've said about winners in the past, sort of the nouveau riche of the nouveau riche. And so I don't think there's a thing in the house other than the winners that are older than the day they won. Something that I can relate to. But, you know, looking around the house, you're going to see more than anything, two things. You're going to see brand new appliances and equipment and a lot of family and friends hanging around just seeing what's going on.
And the horses are not fed.
The horses
and this
are
wasn't
not
even
fed.
This wasn't on a ranch. This was like actually in Dallas.
It's like a suburb. I mean, okay. It's a place where I guess it's not that uncommon to have horses, but at the same time, we're not talking about a dude ranch here. We're talking about, you know, a big, beautiful front yard and, you know, two horses that were looking like they'd hop a bus if they were given the chance.
Now, aside from questions of taste, okay, the gilded look and lamé jumpsuits aren't your taste. Is she spending beyond her means? Is that normal for a recent lottery winner?
Well, it is. Especially most lottery winners who won prior to the year 2000, virtually all of them had to take their prize in an annuity rather than in a lump sum. And so they're doled out their winnings over a period of 20, possibly 25, 26 years. And so someone who wins $1 million in the lottery is really only getting after taxes, you know, about $35,000 a year. Even someone who wins $10 million is just getting $500,000 a year, and that's before taxes. And so they're probably looking at close to $350,000. And so they really start to live beyond their means, especially annuitized lottery winners, almost from day one. You know, you hear stories all the time. One of the first winners I ever heard of, a very infamous lottery winner named Bud Post, who is now dead, but won the lottery in Pennsylvania in, I think, the mid or early 80s. 3 weeks after he won, hit the lottery where he was getting $500,000 a year, he spent his $500,000. And 3 months after the day he won, he was in debt. $500,000. And so it's just, you go from nothing into something. And unless you're very savvy about the way you go into that process and you surround yourself with the right types of advisors, you know, it's a long shot odds that you're going to get out of it without knocking down a few stupid doors.
Now, you hear, you say to yourself or your relative, long lost relative, hears that you won $2 million and they see in their eyes the dollar signs that add up to $2 million. What they don't see is you've really just increased your salary by, what does that work out to, like $70,000 a year?
That's almost exactly right.
$70,000 a year. Now, if you heard that a relative had a job for $70,000, you wouldn't think of hitting that relative up for a lot of money in most cases. But when you hear $2 million, it's an incentive and an enticement.
Well, Mike, you're absolutely right. And that almost goes directly to the core of the issue. You know, that starts on the day they win, because when someone wins the lottery department doesn't say, hey, guess what? Mike Pesca is our new winner. He's getting $70,000 a year. Isn't that great? You know, what they say is he's a $2 million winner. Don't you want to be a millionaire like Mike? What kind of car is he going to buy? Where is he going to park his boat? How many horses is he going to have in his front yard?
So for PR purposes, it's totally in the lottery's interest not to even discuss the fact that the payments are strung out like they are.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that the whole reason that lotteries were paid out over time in the first place was because of the marketing and publicity purposes and benefit of having it done like that.
How much does it actually cost the state to pay out $2 million if they're really only paying out $70,000 a year?
Well, there are several different ways that the lotteries can go ahead and make the investment necessary to pay out the $2 million. They, regardless of the back-end financial mechanism, they buy treasury strips or they go in and just buy a straight annuity. No, not too different than if you or I went into any bank in the country and said, I want to buy an annuity that over the course of 20 years is going to pay me X dollars a year and equal $2 million.
Right.
And they would say, okay, well, that's going to cost you, you know, this much up front. And typically, you know, if someone won $2 million, it's likely that the lottery's investment is going to be somewhere close to $1 million. Mm-hmm. And over time, that $1 million will stretch out to $2 million.
And the difference is, if you or I did it as private citizens, there's no way we could market it as a lottery because it would be illegal. But also, I get the feeling that people would say, hey, you're ripping me off. It's not really $2 million. Somehow, with the state advertising budget behind it, that fact is lost on the players.
Well, not only is it lost on the players, but you know, now as a direct result of the lump sum industry, which many people raise an eyebrow at, and for some good reasons and some not so good. But the lotteries themselves now do, of course, offer the lump sum option to the winners. And what I think there's over 80, if not 85% of new winners take the lump sum option.
Mm-hmm.
And but the cat is now out of the bag as far as $2 million really being just $1 million. One of the things that did for the lump sum industry when the lotteries themselves started offering that, of course, it really hurt business, but it did give credit to the fact that the lotteries or the lump sum industry wasn't ripping anybody off.
Right, you guys have credibility because people say, oh, these guys aren't fly by night, and they may be, but they say it's just like what the state is offering me, a payment up front.
Right.
In general, should you take the state's payment up front?
Absolutely.
Really?
I mean, one of the reasons as odd of a business as this was that I was in, if I won the lottery today, if you did, if my grandmother did, or my wife did, God willing, any one of those could, the first thing that I would tell them to do is to take the lump sum. You know, the problem isn't with the lump sum. The lump sum, in my opinion, is the absolute right way to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the problem is the people that you have to sell it to in the middle, and you make sure that you get the best deal possible.
Take the lump sum from the
government. Take the lump sum from the government,
right,
if you can, and take the lump sum from the secondary market. Just be savvy as hell about how you're doing that, and make sure you put yourself with advisors and people that are a lot more intelligent than you are, who are going to tell you how to negotiate and cut this deal.
Okay, well, speaking of intelligent people playing the lottery, Jim from Kalamazoo.
Hey, hi, how are you?
Tell me your story and your relationship to the lottery.
Well, I am a lottery player. I just wanted to say that my wife is a statistician, and we discuss the lottery all the time, as well as all of our friends with her, and we still play the lottery. Although, if the odds are 350-1, we are, in fact, one.
I thought I was one.
If anyone should know better, it should be us. But we still do it because, hey, why not? It's the chance. A $1 ticket, why not?
What's your weekly or monthly outlay?
Say that again?
How much
not very much at all. At most, $5.
Mm-hmm. And have you ever won anything?
On Scratch, I think the most we've ever won was about $15.
Uh-huh. And that hooked you in for the next 150 worth
exactly
of tickets. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. That 15 went right back to them.
Well, thanks for the call, Jim.
Hey, thank you. Bye-bye.
Sure. Plus, there's a carpal tunnel syndrome of all that scratching.
Yeah, that's
but is Jim, of the winners, were the winners these occasional players, or did most of the winners you deal with, were they heavy-duty players?
Well, the majority, of course, are heavy-duty players. I mean, logic would tell you that's so. At the same time, I know several people, including, as a matter of fact, someone that I write about in the book, who the first time they ever bought a lottery ticket, they won tens of millions of dollars, the first dollar they ever spent. That'll make you rip your hair out if you really think about it. And especially the people that are longtime players, you know, it makes them taste bile to even consider the fact. But yeah, you know, but at the same time, some people, for example, there's another winner who I know quite well who won the lottery, was a scratch millionaire twice, actually won twice. And as astounding as that sounds, and you say to yourself, well, what are the odds? Let me help narrow down the odds for you by telling you that every morning this winner goes out and buys 1,000 scratch lottery tickets. So if you're spending $1,000 a day on scratchers, you're pretty much helping your odds a lot. Now, it's still pretty wild that this person has won $1 million plus two times. However, buying $1,000 a day in scratch lottery ticket is definitely going to put the odds in your favor. At least more than yours or mine.
Are the scratch tickets much worse odds than the numbers, the lotto and the Powerball odds?
I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I think that the odds of winning something with a scratcher, of course, is much greater than winning.
Yeah. Like a free ticket.
Exactly.
That eventually leads to nothing.
But at the same time,
yeah,
odds are odds. And right, so, you know, the odds of winning the jackpots, I'm sure, are equally as high. You know, the odds aren't very good across the board.
No. Do the states have it so that the odds can't dip beyond a certain point to keep it fair enough for the player?
I think absolutely. And I think, you know, the states, the thing is that's so interesting about the state lotteries is that lotteries for the most part can play it straight. You know, lotteries don't have to cheat you. They mm-hmm. don't have to pretend that there's a winner out there when there really isn't. You know, just playing it on the straight and narrow, there's plenty of money to be made. So yeah, if they say there's a winner in Poughkeepsie, you know what? There's a winner in Poughkeepsie. If they say that there's still a $1 million scratcher out there, there still is. There are people coming in. You know, this is I think the lottery last year made close to, you know, the lotteries across the nation made $60 billion. There's plenty to make just doing it right.
Yeah. And is there a best way to win the lottery other than you say take the lump sum?
Or is it the same in the lump sum industry?
Yeah, that's the way to win. But I mean, I guess it's that the guy who is financially savvy in all parts of his life probably will be able to apply that to lottery, but the rub is that guy's not playing in the first place.
Yeah, that guy's not playing. I mean, you know, there's no, you know, by the way, I tell you, especially now that, you know, I have a book out on the market and my book is listed on Amazon and with other lottery books.
Yeah.
These lottery books sell like hotcakes. How to win the lottery. Guaranteed to win. Sell like hotcakes. Makes me want to die.
How to Win the Lottery. Subtitle, Never Pick 8.
Right.
We're talking with Ed Ugel about his book, Money for Nothing. It's about lotteries and the lump sum industry. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-989-8255. And also send us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Mike Pesca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Mike Pesca in Washington. We're talking about lotteries this hour. In a moment, we'll get a look inside the lottery industry. But first, my guest is Ed Ugel. He's got a look inside the lump sum industry, which pays lottery winners money on future earnings. His book is called Money for Nothing, One Man's Journey Through the Dark Side of Lottery Millions. If you're a lottery winner or loser, probably more of the latter, you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And before we go to a call, a correction. I referenced that the Illinois State Lottery was thinking of leasing itself, could get $10 billion. That plan was rejected. Other states have, though, leased the lottery to private corporations. Let's see if we could get John from Cleveland, Ohio, to join us. Hi, John.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
So what's your lottery story?
Well, I hit for $10.5 million, and I quit work, and things are just fine.
How did you take your payment? Do you space it out?
Cash.
You took a lump sum.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
How dare you, sir? And how did you come to that decision?
I consulted. The first thing I did is I consulted a number of lawyers and bank people, and interviewed them, and then talked to an accountant.
And Ed, that's exactly what you say to do.
Exactly. Not only consult the lawyers and the accountants, but also in the end, you know, take the lump sum. I imagine, John, that you have many, many fewer friends and interested parties hanging off of you than, you know, someone down the road who decided to take the annuity because you've taken the cash and in many ways you're off the grid.
Right. I was also completely anonymous.
Yeah, which is one of the main points in my book is that if the lotteries allowed more winners to claim their prizes anonymously, you would be having a very different conversation. The fact that this guy took the cash and claimed it anonymously means night and day.
John, the story is you always hear about long-lost relatives. Did that really happen to you? Did you hear from
nope.
a lot? Because you were anonymous.
Nope, no long lost relatives.
Are you looking to adopt a 35-year-old guy?
Same, yeah. What's the difference? I don't have to work.
No, I wanted to ask you about the anonymity. Did you? How did you know to ask for that, or did the state just say to you, "Hey, do you want to do press?" And you said no. Why was it even an option in your case?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I wanted to know: did the state give you that option up front? Would you like to be anonymous, or would you like to do some publicity? How did you know you could even be anonymous in claiming your prize?
Bad connection or something. Can you speak up louder?
I'll try it one more time, which is, how did you know that you could be anonymous in claiming your prize? How did you know you could opt for anonymity? Yep.
I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay. So, John, we thank you for the call, and maybe new telecom system would be some way to spend the money, but go ahead.
You know, I would tell you that I imagine that he claimed his prize anonymously through a trust in Ohio. To the best of my understanding, out of the 42 lottery states, only two allow their winners to claim their prizes anonymously. Michigan, which has done so for years, and very recently Delaware. And I would tell you that the winners in Michigan long-term are a lot happier as a consequence, because their faces and their names and likenesses aren't plastered all over the TV and internet, et cetera.
Fascinating. And does that mean you, as the lump sum salesman, can't get to those people?
I'll put it to you this way. It's a heck of a lot harder. But when you've got this many zeros up for grabs and there's so many dollars up in the air, we found a way to find them. But it was a heck of a lot harder in Michigan than it was everywhere else in the nation.
Elizabeth from Bend, Oregon. Thanks for joining us, Elizabeth.
Hi. I was just going to say my husband and I are restaurant and bar owners. And this subject is a little morally conflicting for me, because we, of course, are the land of video poker here in Oregon, as well as normal lottery and scratch it and Powerball and all that good stuff. But we, of course, make a lot of money off of it, but we also see who's in there spending their extra $10 on gambling, and it honestly seems like a tax oftentimes on the, you know, uneducated, lower-income folks.
The people who could at least afford to pay it. Is it different from just the bar industry, where maybe you're serving drinks to the dedicated drinker, if you will?
Absolutely. Yep.
It's sadder, is what you're saying.
Right. It's just interesting to see day in and day out the people forking over their well-earned, you know, money.
How much money do you make from the lottery?
What's that?
How much money do you make from the video terminals?
I'd have to ask my husband the exact details, but we split the winnings, and it used to be 30. We would keep 30%, the state keeps 70, and I'm not sure if those numbers are still accurate. But the state upkeeps the machines, they provide the machines. So,
what about payouts? I mean, if there's a big payout, are you on the hook?
We're on the hook for up to $2,000,
okay.
And above that, they have to go to a state lottery office, which we're in Central Oregon, so they have to drive across the mountains to pick up the rest of their winnings.
And you
have to have a certain amount of cash on hand at all times.
Ed, you're familiar with the Oregon lottery.
Yeah, I lived in Portland and actually was a bartender in Portland for many years. And so I was on both sides of this, because I used to play a lot of video poker myself when I wasn't pulling bar shifts, where I was watching the people play on the machines. Would you agree, being an owner, that there's a big difference between the traditional lottery system and these new video lottery terminals, these video poker terminals, as far as how addictive they are to the citizens of the state of Oregon?
Absolutely. It's, you know, there are comparisons to it similar to the crack industry in the 80s, that it's just horribly addicting.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your call, Elizabeth.
You're welcome.
And joining us now is Rebecca Hargrove. She's the president and CEO of the Tennessee Education Lottery Corporation, and she's worked in the lottery industry for over 22 years. She joins us from a studio in Tennessee. Thanks for joining us, Rebecca.
How are you today?
We're good. We're good. Now, I couldn't help but noticing the word education is right in there in the title of the corporation that you work for, or the state fund that you work for. Tell us, how much money goes to education from the lottery in Tennessee?
Well, we're about 3.5 years old, and in that 3.5 years, we've raised $1 billion for the education programs that we fund.
And a criticism of some state lotteries that claim to give a lot to education is that it just diverts state money that would have gone there anyway. Is that the case in Tennessee?
Absolutely not. By constitutional amendment, when the lottery legislation and amendment passed here in Tennessee, it was mandated by law that our dollars can only go to programs that did not exist prior to the lottery. We do not fund K through 12 education. We fund college scholarships, pre-kindergarten programs, and after-school programs. Very similar to the Georgia lottery, which by constitutional amendment does the same thing.
Where you used to
work. They are not replacement dollars, they're enhancement dollars.
And in Tennessee, the lottery is relatively new, 3 years old?
Three and a half. At the time we raised the $1 billion, we'll be 4 years old this month.
Are more and more people playing every year?
Well, our sales have increased every year. You know, some of that certainly may be, you know, an increase of population as well as additional games. As you mature in a lottery, you have the opportunity to offer more games. As an example, we weren't in Powerball at startup because of the technology required to do that. We started with instant tickets and then added games slowly over time.
And Rebecca, you have the reputation as sort of, I don't know, an Andy Grove or a Bill Gates of lottery. You have a mind for thinking up games, from what I understand. Take me inside the mind of a lottery tinkerer, the Edison of lotteries. What's an example of a kind of game that you invented that became really popular?
Well, yeah, there are a number of people who collaborate on anything that happens in our industry. I happen to, because I've been around so long, been one of those collaborators. I remember in Florida, and I'll talk a little bit about other winter experiences I've had that are different than Ed's, but in Florida, we'd had a $100 million jackpot, and the legislature thought that that was too much money for one person and wanted us to cap jackpots at $1 million apiece. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, the bigger the jackpot, more people play. So therefore, that would hurt the dollars that we were able to raise to fund education programs. So we introduced a game called Fantasy Five, which now has played a very similar game like that in almost every state in the nation. But it was a game where you had the opportunity to win $1 million 3 times a week, as opposed to, you know, the $100 million that you had the opportunity to win once every 2 years or so. But that was a game introduced in the late 80s in Florida when I was down there doing startup of the Florida Lottery. But I would like to address winners for a second, if I may.
Please do.
I have met hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of winners. And what I've found is because our players come from every walk of life, our winners come from every walk of life. I've seen the silk stocking lawyer win in Atlanta. I've seen the architect from Miami win. I had a woman who won $56 million in Florida who started a foundation for battered and abused women in Orange and Seminole counties. Actually, I had lunch with her one day, and she had on jeans and was moving furniture in the foundation office. And I looked at her and said, you know, Sheila, you won $56 million. Why don't you hire somebody to move the furniture? Her response to me was, well, then I wouldn't have as much money for people who really need it. So that, you know, there are winners from all walks of life. And like the gentleman who called in from Cleveland, those don't make press stories or maybe aren't the people that Ed's gone to do a lump sum with. There are two other points I would like to make.
Well, first, let me just ask you about the winners that you come into contact with. I mean, they're certainly inspiring anecdotes, maybe even the cornerstone of marketing campaigns. But according to independent lottery research, which does research and marketing for state lotteries, such players represent only 10 to 15% of all players, but they account, meaning the dedicated player, the player that bets over $100 a week, such players represent only 10 to 15% of all players, but account for 80% of sales. So a small percentage of players, the very dedicated players, are driving the lotteries, according to this independent research firm. Does that jibe with your statistics?
I've not seen that report. I don't know that company. So I really can't address a report I've not seen. We find that the average player in Tennessee spends $3 to $5 a week. And if you look at our sales, which are roughly $1 billion a year in a state with a population of 6 million people, it would be hard for that $1 billion a year to come from 10% of our population. Those numbers just don't jive.
Let's see. I'm doing the math here in my head. That comes out to 6 million, so maybe let's call it 5 million of people 18 and over divided by a billion. That means people are betting an average of $200 on the lottery in Tennessee a year?
I'm not sure your adult population figure is correct, but
it's in the neighborhood, right?
Yeah, probably.
So 200, I mean, is that good? Is that good that Tennessee residents are spending an average of $200 a year on the lottery?
Well, it certainly raises $1 billion of the education programs that we fund, and we had players win over $2 billion in winnings. So, you know, there are lots of winners.
All right. Ed, did you want to say something?
No, I mean, you know, Rebecca Hargrove is immensely talented. I mean, her reputation genuinely precedes her. And her job, frankly, is to make the Tennessee Lottery money. And she's very good at that job and very well compensated for it, as she should be. You know, my issue isn't with Rebecca Hargrove. My issue is with, I think that, you know, if she were to work in the private sector or she were to work, for example, in a casino, I would worship at her feet. I think that she's one of the most interesting sales and marketing minds in the gambling world I've ever heard of. What I have an issue with, and what I write about in the book is that because she's under the umbrella of the state itself, that whether or not it's Illinois or Georgia or Florida or now Tennessee, that there is a difference earning this money, whether it's for the children. You know, we always say, oh, it's for the children, for the education. It is. And by the way, Georgia and Tennessee, both of which Mrs. Hargrove deserves immense credit for, have a tremendous reputation for really putting money towards education. But still, doing that, raising that money on the backs of their own citizens, many of whom struggle with gambling and gambling addiction, in my opinion, there are cleaner ways to skin that cat.
The one quote I have underlined in your whole book, Ed, goes right to that point. It's, I'm not implying that the word lottery carries some benevolent imagery, but the word state should. Let's take a call. I think we have Mike from St. Louis. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to address that issue myself, which has bugged me for many years. I never gambled, but I'm not against gambling. I think it's fine if you want to do it. But here we have the state selling to us and the children the idea that you should work hard to get ahead, and then turning around and sort of trying to finance that message by saying, don't work hard, just gamble here, and then really soliciting people to do something that everyone knows is a bad deal.
Rebecca, would you want to address that?
Well, the last Gallup poll I saw said that 76% of the population of America believes that lotteries are an effective way to raise needed funds. Every state that has a lottery has done so either by a vote of the people who voted that they wanted one, or passed legislation by the people's elected officials saying they want a lottery. So it's really a public policy decision that the people in each jurisdiction make. And it's the public vote that says, yes, we want a lottery, and yes, we want it run by the state, that has set up the industry that I participate in. Now, Mike, you said earlier that some lotteries have leased or sold their, some states have leased or sold their lotteries.
I think Indiana did, yeah.
Well, no, there are several states that have discussed it. No one has done that yet. Indiana's discussed it. California's discussed it. Illinois's discussed it. Texas has discussed it. Vermont has. Rhode Island has. But no one has actually taken that step yet. And I think the reason that there is government control on lotteries goes back to a scandal in Louisiana in the late 1800s, where lotteries were run like casinos by private enterprise without any governmental control.
And before,
so, you know, there are histories on why things are the way they are.
And Mike, I want to thank you for the call. Rebecca, we have to let you go in a second. Here's my one question. Everyone compliments you for your mind and your marketing. One of the justifications for the lottery is let's have the state do it because people are going to do it anyway. But if we have such brilliant minds in the state doing their job, which is to say growing their base, aren't we using the state to convince people to gamble while they otherwise wouldn't be gambling?
I'm not sure that our player is as naive as you portray them to be. I think our players in Tennessee were either playing in Tunica right across the border from Tennessee, mm-hmm. or buying Georgia lottery tickets or Virginia lottery tickets or Kentucky lottery tickets. So, or you know, they go up to Metropolis and do riverboat gaming. If they want to play a game of chance, they would rather those dollars help educate Tennessee children rather than Georgia or Virginia or Kentucky children. And I don't think our player is that naive to say, well, it's okay because the state does it. I think our player says it's fair.
Got
because it. Our state does it.
And Ed, a final thought.
Well, I think that while Mrs. Hargrove is correct that, of course, the lotteries were all voted in by the states, I don't think anybody voted for video poker machines or for these new NASCAR-type games that they have in the bars of Tennessee, where they run every 5 minutes from 6 a.m. to 1 a.m. in the morning, and you can win. I don't think anybody had that in mind when they pulled that lever in the ballot box.
Well, the lottery is both a source of entertainment and an educational discussion, so thank you, Rebecca Paul Hargrove. And thank you, Ed Ugel, author of Money for Nothing, One Man's Journey Through the Dark Side of Lottery Millions. We'll be back in a second or two to talk about strife in Kenya. This is Talk of the Nation.